Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The military wing of the Palestinian Hamas movement claims responsibility for the retaliatory operation in an Israeli settlement, saying it will not be the last of its kind. A Saudi prince says Riyadh feels, quote, let down by Washington in tackling security threats to the kingdom, citing U.S. decision to end support for Saudi-led war in Yemen. Also, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says sanctions imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine will not be lifted until Moscow reaches a peace agreement with Kiev. Thank you for joining us. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas claims responsibility for the retaliatory operation conducted on Friday in an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. Azzedine al-Ghassam Brigade says the operation was a response to the regime's aggressions against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestinian worshippers. The group said it takes pride in this operation, which was carried out by its fighters. Hamas's military wing added that its forces are fighting along with other resistance forces across the occupied territories. Azzedine al-Ghassam Brigades warned that the Friday operation will not be the last of its kind. On Friday, an Israeli guard was killed in an aerial settlement situated near the city of Nablus. Earlier the same day, Israeli forces had attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied East Al-Quds, leaving at least 42 fasting Palestinians injured. Israel has escalated its aggressions against Muslims' third holiest site in recent weeks. A senior Saudi prince criticizes the U.S. in tackling what he calls security threats to the kingdom and the region by Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Prince Turki al-Faisal said Saudi Arabia felt let down at a time it thought both sides would jointly face the danger. It was referring to Yemeni missile and drone attacks. The former Saudi spy chief also cited a U.S. decision to end its support for Saudi-led offensive in Yemen. He went on to list U.S. President Joe Biden's refusal last year to meet Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his move to temporarily withdraw anti-missile systems from the kingdom. Relations between Riyadh and Washington remain tense over a number of issues, including the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist and Saudi consulate in Turkey. The U.S. is also angry as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have resisted calls to help tame oil prices amid the Russia-Ukraine war. The Iranian president has called on Muslim countries to make every effort to stop inhumane Israeli attacks on Palestinians. Ibrahim Raisi said that a goal can be achieved through cooperation and tapping into international capacities. The Iranian president made the remarks in a phone call with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Raisi said Iran's policy is to, quote, meaningfully promote all-out ties with regional countries, particularly Turkey. For his part, the Turkish president expressed his keenness to travel to Tehran. Erdogan said he would like to discuss regional and international developments as well as the expansion of Tehran-Ankara ties during the visit. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses have told Press TV about his dire situation. They say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over allegations of human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq back in the 1980s. His family says his arrest was illegal. They accuse the Swedish judicial system of issuing an arrest warrant for him without an independent investigation and based on untrue claims by some people. Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials didn't allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as political show. The MKO was responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Another instance of Quran burning has erupted in Sweden as a notorious racist activist from Denmark continues his Quran burning tour of Sweden. Fears are high of a return to the 4 days of violence, which saw furious Muslims vent their anger at authorities over the Easter weekend burnings. Robert Carter is in Stockholm and brings us the latest.
Quran burnings have once again returned to Sweden as far-right Danish activist Rasmus Paludan desecrated the holy book outside Stockholm's central masjid on Sunday. Later that same day, he travelled to Uppsala and attempted to burn another, but local Muslims chased him off, one nearly being run over in the process. Paludan is a notorious leader of a far-right political party which stood in the last Danish elections, receiving just 1.8% of the vote, failing to win a seat. In 2020, he was jailed for racism and other offences. Throughout the month of Ramadan, Paludan has toured Sweden, burning Qurans in several Muslim-majority areas in various cities, sparking 4 days of violent unrest over the Easter weekend. Local Swedish opposition Nuance Party condemned the authorities for allowing the burnings.
Well, actually, in Sweden, you're not allowed to say or do whatever you want. So this concept of freedom of speech is already has its rules and its regulations. For example, 3 years ago, a neo-Nazi party burnt the Pride flag, the flag that the LGBTQ movement uses. And for that, they were charged for hate speech or hate against a certain people. Nowadays, the politicians, they don't account Muslims into these kind of minorities. On one hand, they're defending other minorities and their rights to be left alone or to not be hated against. And on the other hand, they are defending people who are hating it towards or against Muslims.
There's no word to describe our disappointment to the other political parties and the public figures that are defending him. We don't see any political parties that are going out and defending the Muslims and that are talking about issues that facing Muslims. So I think that is why this is happening.
Peace and tranquility has returned to Sweden, but tensions remain high as both local Muslims and the Swedish authorities know that the Quran burners will be back. Paludan has made absolutely clear that he intends to run in the Swedish elections this September, and it's very likely that he will bring further unrest back with him. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Welcome back. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says sanctions imposed on Russia over the Ukraine war will not be lifted until Moscow reaches a peace agreement with Kiev. Scholz said Russia is mistaken if it thinks it can gain territory from Ukraine and then stop the war. The German chancellor said Russian President Vladimir Putin underestimated the resistance of Ukraine. Scholz added that Putin didn't think the West would support Ukraine to the current extent. He said it is for Ukraine to determine the terms of any peace agreement. Scholz also rejected criticism over Germany's delayed military aid to Ukraine. Scholz is under pressure at home and abroad to supply Ukraine with heavy arms and support EU sanctions on Russia's energy imports. Daily requests for Russian gas deliveries to Europe through Ukraine have hit a five-month high despite tensions over the war in Ukraine. That's according to data from a transmission system operator in Slovakia. The data shows even the Russian gas to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 showed an increase on Monday. Meanwhile, EU energy ministers held an emergency meeting to discuss a Russian threat of halting natural gas exports unless European countries make their payments in rubles. Moscow has already cut off supplies to Bulgaria and Poland due to their refusal to pay in rubles. This, as a Hungarian official says, at least 10 EU countries are already buying Russian gas with rubles. The EU Commission, however, says it is not aware of any company agreeing to comply with the Russian demand.
We don't have any information that this is true. On the contrary, right now, Commission doesn't have information about any country or private company who is willing to do so.
The EU official also dismissed the option of paying for Russia's gas in rubles through a conversion scheme managed by Moscow. She called it a breach of the bloc sanctions and is not acceptable. She made the remarks during the EU energy ministerial meeting in Brussels. The European Commission is expected to propose a sixth package of sanctions against Russia over its war with Ukraine later this week. The package will include a ban on Russian oil imports. Germany says it's ready to support the embargo, but has warned that such a move would require a lot of preparations. The European Union imports 40% of its natural gas and 26% of its crude oil from Russia. A senior U.S. official says Russia plans to, quote, annex the two eastern regions of Ukraine after failing to overthrow the Kiev government. The U.S. ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said Russia plans to engineer referenda in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions sometime in mid-May. Michael Carpenter said, highly credible reports indicate that Russia is considering a similar plan in Ukraine's Kherson region, which is now under its control. It said such, quote, sham referenda and attempts to annex additional Ukrainian territory will not be considered legitimate. In addition to Donetsk and Luhansk regions, the U.S. and its allies consider Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula following a 2014 referendum illegal. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid an unannounced visit to Kiev in the latest show of support for Ukraine and its fight against Russia by a senior Western politician. The U.S. and its allies have supplied significant quantities of arms to Kiev and imposed economic sanctions on Russia. But such approaches were not only unhelpful to put an end to the war, rather proved fuel to the fire.
Leading a congressional delegation, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid a visit to Ukraine. Pelosi, who is the highest-ranking American leader to visit Ukraine since the start of the war, has reiterated Washington's support for Ukraine. During a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
The United States is in an explicit war to weaken Russia and to defeat Russia, to help Ukrainian government defeat Russia in Ukraine. And it's, you know, Zelensky is really is someone who isn't making the decisions here. He's not going to be allowed to make a deal unless the United States lets him, and unless the right-wing forces in Ukraine let him.
Zelensky, for his part, thanked the U.S. and its Congress for, in his own words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi's visit comes as the U.S. and its allies are stepping up to provide long-term support to Ukraine as the fighting rages on. Later in a statement, Pelosi said Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. has already committed $4.3 billion to Kyiv in military support since 2021. Now, in a major increase of such funding, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in emergency funding for Ukraine, including $20 billion for military aid. Moscow has warned that the aid would only fuel the conflict. Also, last week, responding to pleas from Zelensky, a group of 40 nations gathered by the U.S. and Germany agreed to streamline and expedite the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. Western nations have imposed broad economic sanctions on Russia and have been shipping increasing quantities of weapons to confront Russian forces. The Western intervention could lead to Russia's military response and raise the risk of confrontation between Russia and NATO, as well as a nuclear conflict. Some experts believe Washington's war aims had broadened from helping Ukraine to defend itself to damaging Russia itself. This notion supports the Russian narrative that Moscow's actions in Ukraine are to defend itself against NATO.
Russia, meanwhile, has hit a U.S. weapons warehouse at an airfield near Odessa, which also housed Western-supplied arms and ammunition. At the same time, it is threatening to retaliate if other countries target its soil. These developments show there is no end in sight to the war. This also as Russia and Ukraine have failed to reach a consensus in their peace talks.
U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed a $33 billion package for arming and supporting Ukraine. He also outlined proposed new laws to transfer the frozen assets of Russia's elite to Ukraine. The proposal is part of U.S. policies to ratchet up economic pressure on Russia over the Ukraine war. On the other hand, Moscow has warned that it may seize the Russian-based assets of countries it considers hostile. The Speaker of Russia's lower house of parliament says the proceeds from the sale of these assets will be used for the country's development. Vyacheslav Volodin accused some countries of violating international law and resorting to pure theft. He particularly named Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, and even the United States. Volodin said the U.S. has set a dangerous precedent that could backfire. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said on Sunday it had carried out a missile strike on a military airfield near the port city of Odessa, destroying a runway and a hangar containing weapons and ammunition supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. and European countries. That's after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned that any shipment of weapons by NATO into Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Russia. Lavrov had also blamed Ukraine for the current impasse in the peace talks, accusing Kyiv of a desire to play games. He said the negotiations could have produced results if it was not for the interference of the United States and Britain.
Are they willing to go all in a war against Russia here? They are going to have to put massive amounts of weaponry in. And the Russians are going to try to prevent that. So we are in a very dangerous place where there's a significant possibility of not only a regional, but a world war.
Moscow has also blasted the West for encouraging Ukraine to strike Russia. That's after UK Defense Minister Ben Wallace said Ukraine has the right to strike military targets inside Russia. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier that any country deemed to be interfering in Ukraine would meet a lightning-fast response using weapons.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Thanks for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William I. Robinson, author. This article is published under the heading, Global Capitalism Has Become Dependent on War-Making to Sustain Itself. This is the second part of the article. By 2018, private for-profit military companies employed some 15 million people around the world, while another 20 million people worked in private security worldwide. The private security policing business is one of the fastest-growing economic sectors in many countries and has come to dwarf public security around the world. The amount spent on private security in 2003, the year of the invasion of Iraq, was 73% higher than that spent in the public sphere. And three times as many persons were employed in private forces as in official law enforcement agencies. In half of the world's countries, private security agents outnumber police officers. These corporate soldiers and police were deployed to guard corporate property, provide personal security for executives and their families, collect data, conduct police, paramilitary, counterinsurgency, and surveillance operations, carry out mass crowd control and repression of protesters, run private detention and interrogation facilities, manage prisons, and participate in outright warfare. Now, these same private military and security firms are pouring into Ukraine, with some mercenary companies offering between $1,000 and $2,000 a day for those with combat experience. The fact that this explosion in spending coincides perfectly with continued worldwide stagnation following the Great Recession suggests that the heightened militarization of the global economy is as much or more a response to this chronic stagnation than to perceived security threats. If bursts of militarized accumulation, such as that unleashed by 9/11, then by the 2008 financial collapse, and now, by the crisis in Eastern Europe, help offset the over-accumulation crisis further into the future, they are also high-risk bets that heighten worldwide tensions and push the world dangerously towards all-out international conflagration. This crisis of global capitalism is economic or structural, one of the chronic stagnation in the global economy, but it is also political, a crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. The system is moving towards a general crisis of capitalist rule as billions of people around the world face uncertain struggles for survival and question a system they no longer see as legitimate. Historically, wars have pulled the capitalist system out of crisis while they serve to deflect attention from political tensions and problems of legitimacy. Economically, global capitalism faces what is known in technical language as over-accumulation, a situation in which the economy has produced or has the capacity to produce great quantities of wealth, but the market cannot absorb this wealth because of escalating inequality. Capitalism, by its very nature, will produce abundant wealth, yet polarize that wealth and generate ever greater levels of social inequality unless offset by redistributive policies. The level of global social polarization and inequality now experienced is without precedent. In 2018, the richest 1% of humanity controlled more than half of the world's wealth, while the bottom 80% had to make do with just 5%. The International Development Agency Oxfam reported in January that during the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic, the 10 richest men in the world more than doubled their fortunes from $700 billion to $1.5 trillion, while 99% of humanity saw a fall in their income and 160 million more people fell into poverty. Such inequalities end up undermining the stability of the system as the gap grows between what is or could be produced and what the market can absorb. The extreme concentration of the planet's wealth in the hands of the few and the accelerated impoverishment and dispossession of the majority means that the transnational capitalist class, or TCC, has increasing difficulty in finding productive outlets to upload enormous amounts of surplus it accumulated. In the years leading up to the pandemic, there was a steady rise in the underutilized capacity and slowdown in industrial production around the world. The surplus of accumulated capital with nowhere to go expanded rapidly. Transnational corporations recorded record profits during the 2010s at the same time that corporate investment declined. Along with militarized accumulation, the TCC has turned to unprecedented levels of financial speculation and to debt-driven growth to sustain profit-making in the face of the crisis. If left unchecked, over-accumulation results in crisis, in stagnation, recessions, depression, social upheavals, and war, just what people are experiencing right now. But there is a related dynamic at work in the global war economy. The need for dominant groups to suppress mass discontent and deflect the crisis of state legitimacy. International frictions escalate as states, in their effort to retain legitimacy, seek to sublimate social and political tensions and to keep the social order from fracturing. All around the world, a people's spring has taken off. From Chile to India, France to US, Haiti to Nigeria, South Africa to Colombia, Jordan to Sri Lanka, waves of strikes and mass protests have proliferated and in some instances appear to be acquiring an anti-capitalist character. Wars and external enemies allow the ruling groups to deflect attention away from domestic melee in their effort to maintain a grip on power as the crisis deepens. In the U.S., this sublimation has involved efforts to channel social unrest towards scapegoated communities such as immigrants or other marginalized groups. This is one key function of racism and was a core component of the Trump administration's political strategy, or towards an external enemy, which had clearly become a cornerstone of the Biden government's strategy well before the crisis in Eastern Europe. U.S. presidents historically reach their highest approval ratings when they launch wars. George W. Bush reached an all-time high of 90% in 2001 as his administration geared up to invade Afghanistan, and his father, George H. W. Bush, achieved an 89% approval rating in 1991. Right as the U.S. declared the end of its first invasion of Iraq and the liberation of Kuwait. It is unlikely that an increasing militarization of the world economy can, in the long run, offset either the economic or the political dimensions of the crisis of global capitalism. Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. In the U.S., the class struggle is heating up with a wave of strikes and of unionization drives in Amazon, Starbucks, and elsewhere in the gig economy. The current inflationary spiral and the escalation of the class struggle in the United States and around the world point to the inability of the ruling groups to contain the expanding crisis. The drive by the capitalist state to externalize the political fallout of the crisis increases the danger that international tensions and localized conflicts will snowball into broader international conflagrations of unforeseen consequences.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atar, the host of this program. This series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, also known as Imam Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So, and Shaykh Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, very recently, in one of the speeches of Imam Khamenei, he talked about a very important concept, which is Jihad al-Tabyin. And so many people in Iran, inside Iran and outside Iran, were shocked by this, we can say, type of look at the world and at the concept of jihad. Because this is the first time that this term has been coined by the Rahbar, and he used it. So now there are so many, we can say, explanations, commentaries and interpretations written on this concept. Of course, Rahbar in his speech gave us a very nice framework for Jihad al-Tabyin, but this is good to be more familiar with this concept, maybe for the English-speaking people all around the world through this radio show, Viewpoints. Even inside the Islamic land, the key holders of the Kaaba and the Mecca, I mean the Wahhabis and all these kings over there, okay, are hand in hand with the enemy of Islam. So, is it at all true to say that Islamic Republic of Iran is alone? Or no, maybe this Jihad al-Tabyin can also attract some people out of the borders of Islam, for example, Christians, Jews, those who are after the social justice, justice seekers across the world, those people who believe in the concept of the last savior, for example. Okay, what's your answer to that?
Well, I think because the Islamic Revolution was based on the pure Muhammadan Islam, and the difference between this country, which is Iran, obviously we know it as the Islamic revolutionary country, not the Iran, the state only the, as in Iran.
Okay.
It's a revolutionary country and it's an Islamic revolutionary country. Therefore, we can see that because the main aim was to gain Islam, to have Islam in this country, to apply the pure Muhammadan Islam in this country. That's why we can see it is on the front foot. And we clearly see Iran being engaged with all these things.
Yes.
But on the other hand, we cannot say it is just Iran. Other people, other countries are also involved, not at the government level. For example, you know, whenever something happens to the against the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam or the Quran, the very first people which we see who have you know, protests and all those things, it always happens in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people themselves. Not the government. I'm not talking about the governments right now.
Yes.
Within the people, we can see, and the Supreme Leader also has said, the belief that the Pakistani Muslims have, they have a firm belief on the Quran and the Prophet.
Yes.
You know, if someone says anything to the Prophet or the Quran, they, according to their beliefs, they do protest. Whether it's happened in the France or in any other part of the world, they stand against it. So we can see people doing that, but because the governments are not sincere, because the governments are following the, you know, the strategy that are set by the capitalist, by the capitalism.
Yes.
They are following a different system. Yes. Within the Islamic State, and they just have the name of the Islamic State. That's why we cannot see these countries, these governments, or the rulers of these countries being with the you know, on the front foot.
Yes.
On the other hand, we can see, like, for example, the example that you gave for the Ahl-e Saud and all those.
Yes.
they're just pretending to be the Muslims. You know, the land which was free of the idols, which was free out of the, you know, all the non-Islamic rituals and all those things, they are just doing that again. They just brought that again. They're like killing people. They finance ISIS. You know, all these things, this shows that they're not the true followers of Islam, but they are the puppets who have been, you know, plotted in mm-hmm. these countries.
Yes.
And we know that there's a term which is used in the Quran, and it can be used in all the times for the enemies, and that is taghut,
mm-hmm.
rebels.
Yes.
Taghut is a good term for all the
yes.
times.
Aggressors.
You know, So we can use this term for anyone. Mm-hmm. And as we know that Imam Khomeini also mentioned that the America is the big Saturn.
Yeah, Shaitan
and the Shaitan Bozor, big Saturn. How it is doing, what it is doing, what he has done to the, you know, again, because we're talking about the current affairs as well, we have this. I have to take the name of Ukraine again.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was what the Prime Minister of Ukraine himself claimed that Iran and the other countries stand firm on your, you know, stances and positions regarding your nuclear power, because this is the trust we did on the U.S., Great Britain, and the Russia Federation, mm-hmm. and now this is happening to us.
You know, there is a verse in the Quran
that
الشَّيْطَانُ يَعِدُكُمُ الْفَقْرِ. The Satan gives you the promise of hunger.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, in reality, maybe in front of you, he says, like, I will protect you, mm-hmm. do not pray to God, do not do this, do not do that. But at the end, when it is the time you need help from the Satan,
he deceives you.
He deceives you, and he will not help you, and the hunger will come after you.
Yes.
Now, Ukraine is being, you know, involved in hunger.
Rapper on Eid al-Mab'as talked about taking lesson from history. You know, I mean, tajrubai tarikhi, taking lesson from history and the experiences that other countries had, and he named different lands, you know. For example, Afghanistan was one of them. You know, the then president of Afghanistan, when he was toppled down and he fled away, in an interview, he talked against the U.S., that U.S. did this and did that, promised me this and promised that. Okay, we will eliminate hunger from your country, famine, something like that, but none of them happened.
Yeah. We have chapter 2, verse number 267.
Yes,
it says, الشَّيْطَانُ يَعِدُكُمُ الْفَقْرَ وَيَأْمُرُكُمْ بِالْفَحْشَى.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Shaitan promises you of the hunger, and he orders you to the indecency, immorality.
Yes.
Wallahu, but Allah, and Allah, يَعِدُكُمُ الْمَغْفِرَةِ.
Yes.
He promises you the forgiveness. Minhu, from him, وَفَضْلَ. And obviously the bounty. Wallahu wasi'un alim. So basically, it is very important to know the taghut, to know your enemy.
Yes.
That was the right thing. But in the methodology, obviously, we have many people who wants to get involved into this jihad.
Yes.
But the first thing is you need to load yourself with the proper weapon for this war. It is a war.
Yes.
This soft war is a war.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not less than the hard war that we had.
Yes.
Obviously, you need to get prepared. You need to load yourself with the proper weapon. If it is the knowledge, you need to get knowledge. It is upon you. If it is about to, you know, learn different, applications or the, you know, the softwares, how to deal with it, how to run, or the social media, how to use it, you need to do it.
You know, the thing that they're doing now, I don't know, have you heard about the Meta Universe or not? The Metaverse and the Meta Project, okay, is a project that the giants of high-tech are doing in order to establish, I mean, create the goggles that you put on your eyes, and then you enter into a world which is absolutely based on the virtual science, and you can make your land, you can buy it. And, you know, the same
company who built the Bitcoin and all those, now they're selling the properties. For example, Taj Mahal has been already sold over there.
Yes, virtual property.
The virtual property, virtual lands.
Yes. And they said that this will finish the corruption. Why? Because everyone knows what you own.
Yes.
So no one can, you know, take it from you. No one can invade you. You know, they cannot crack. The point is, the one who has made this software can crack you. He already has bought everything for himself.
Has got into your mind, you know, through the goggles. You can make your own personality, even with your own characteristics. If you are short in this world, you can make a tall person out of yourself. If you are, I don't know. You
I remember
this,
there was a movie as well.
Yes.
The Hollywood made it.
Yes,
like,
They used to put Player One by Steven Spielberg.
Player One, yeah. So
player
in
one.
That,
game
they put
one.
The goggles, they don't
yes,
have
yes.
the real, in the real world, they don't know each other, they're
okay.
always
That's
you know, got involved in that. The general public, they have different, those who are involved in the IT, they have different, you know, methods, the lawyers, the politicians, they have their own, you know, duties to, they have their own duties to, you know, to perform. So therefore, the methodologies are different. And at this point, obviously, it is hard to just identify. We can identify a couple of them, but not all of them.
Yes.
We cannot just talk about all of them.
Okay.
But Thank obviously, you. it should be, whatever we do, it should be first, be prioritized.
Yes.
First of all, you cannot just do anything. You cannot just put hand in anything. Number two, it should be, you know, in line with the Islamic revolution. because that's the lesson which we learn, obviously.
It should be in line.
It should be in line with the Islamic revolution. Okay. It should be with the scientific and logical support and expertise. It cannot be without that. And be practical. You know, sometimes we are, we want to do something, but in practical life, we are lazy. So your practice and what you think should be the same. And the last thing, but not least, avoid corruption and sedition. You know, sometimes we think that, okay, someone has put a material about me on the internet or somewhere else. I need to save Islam, for example. I cannot put something which is based on lies against that person. You know, the corruption, this is a kind of corruption. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be...
So this jihadist habit must be ethical too.
That is important. Yes. It should be ethical and true. Because Islam is the religion of truth.
Yes.
So we don't need any lies.
We do not play the dirty game
which they are doing. Yeah. We don't need that.
When it comes to the tools required, you know, what is, as Sayyid has mentioned too, the adequate knowledge, right?
Yes.
Being empowered with the knowledge and knowing the subject you're addressing. The second is the ability to promote the correct intellectual discourse, right? Knowledge in itself, you know, which is all over the place, is not enough, right? So you have to develop, and if you already have it, good. If not, then you have to develop the ability to promote the correct intellectual discourse.
That's right.
The third one is the ability to follow the proper reasoning and principles of logic. You know, sometimes people, when they get into this confrontational situation, they put aside logic.
They become emotional
and just, you know, that doesn't help. Yes. The fourth one is Islamic akhlaq, as the leader himself has mentioned, the ethics and morals, which, you know, involves and includes taqwa and sincerity.
That's right.
This is something that's a prerequisite for anyone to enter into this jihad.
Mm-hmm.
Without this, you're going to do more damage than benefit.
Yes.
Then acquaintance with social media tools and techniques.
Yes, like, this is important.
You know, this is very important. If you're going to use it as a means to get to people, you need to know how to work it.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not the least is access to verifiable information, data, and subject matter experts.
That's all right. It's really, I think, a specialized teamwork in order to be done on Jihad al-Tabin. I hope that different groups of the people and those who are interested in this concept, you know, come into the field and, you know, come into the practical aspects of Jihad al-Tabin, because here and there we can see so many people on the members, on the, you know, sermons, giving lectures on the universities and the houses, talking about this. But first of all, we have to understand what is Jihad al-Tabin, what are the categories, what are the main tools. Recently, a book also have been published titled as Jihad al-Tabin by Intisharat Inqilab Islami, Islamic Revolution publication, compiled by Sayyid Sulh Mirzai, which is a great book, I think. It is about more than 500 pages. It is in Farsi language. I hope it's been translated into English language, other languages too. It's a good book, you know, on Jihad al-Tabin. And what rapper has emphasized on different aspects of this Jihad al-Tabin, Jihad for or of clarification explanation. Okay, thank you much.
You're welcome.
Sheikh Ali, really fruitful discussion. And Sayyid Mohsen, thank you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything.
اللهم أهل الكبرياء والعظمة وأهل الجود والجبروت وأهل العفو والرحمة وأهل التقوى والمغفرة أسألك بحق هذا اليوم الذي جعلته للمسلمين عيدا ولمحمد صلى الله عليه وآله زخرا وشرفا وكرامة.
We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate the Islamic Ummah and all world Muslims on the blessed occasion of the Eid al-Fitr. A joyous Eid al-Fitr to you all.
The limelight. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland. The piece is titled, Jacob Rees-Mogg Has Given the Game Away. Even this government knows Brexit is a disaster. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. On a visit to the Eurotunnel terminal at Folkestone, high-visibility gilet over his double-breasted suit, Jacob Rees-Mogg announced that the government was delaying yet again the imposition of post-Brexit border checks on imports from the European Union. He asked the public to celebrate this decision on the grounds that it would save £1 billion a year and help hard-pressed consumers by avoiding an increase in the cost of imported food. Enforcing post-Brexit checks, said the minister, would have been an act of self-harm. You read that right. Jacob Rees-Mogg, the arch-leaver and long-time loather of the European Union, is now parroting lines from the Remain campaign. He's admitting that implementing Brexit in full, honouring the 2016 promise to take back control of Britain's borders, would be an act of self-harm. There's plenty to attack here, starting with the nerve of hailing this move as saving Britain's £1 billion, when this was £1 billion that Britons would never have had to spend at all if it hadn't been for Brexit. Or you could share the outrage of British farmers, appalled that thanks to Brexit they have been left at a serious competitive disadvantage. They now face onerous and costly checks when they ship their goods across the channel, while French, Italian and Spanish farmers face no such hassle moving their farm produce in the other direction. Or you could worry along with the British Veterinary Association, which warns that not checking food imports leaves Britain exposed to catastrophic animal diseases, such as African swine fever, a risk that was reduced when Britain was part of the European Union's integrated and highly responsive surveillance systems. Or you could join the lament of the UK Major Ports Group, whose members have spent hundreds of millions of pounds building checking facilities, which now stand unused as bespoke white elephants. But put all of that aside for now, just for a moment, and grasp the full meaning of Jacob Rees-Mogg's admission. He and his fellow Brexiters once looked forward to these border checks, seeing them not merely as a price worth paying for leaving the European Union, but as a genuine benefit. Britain would at last be free to set its own food standards superior to the European Union's. And yet, now the minister admits that putting up barriers just makes food more expensive for British consumers and risk bankrupting British farmers. Precisely the act of self-harm that Remainers always said it would be. The irony of hearing Jacob Rees-Mogg declare that free trade is hugely advantageous to consumers after he and his comrades pulled us out of the largest, most successful free trade bloc in the world, namely the European single market, would be funny if it weren't so bitter. At a stroke, the Minister for Brexit Opportunities has implicitly admitted that there are none. Or, at the very least, any opportunities are outweighed by costs so great that they represent economic self-mutilation. In the long story of Britain's needless and pointless departure from the European Union, the Rees-Mogg admission should count as a milestone. Which is not to say the Conservatives won't keep banging the Brexit drum, hoping it will rally the electoral coalition it summoned back in 2019. But the sound, always hollow, will now be hollower still. Thanks to Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Brexiteers themselves have admitted as much. This matters not just as a twist in the Brexit saga, but for the life expectancy of this government. For Brexit was this government's founding purpose, when the best that even the loudest advocates for that project can promise is a delay in its realisation, it's clear the drive has gone. And without such a goal, a destination to aim for, governing parties drift and become vulnerable. If the two usual determinants of an incumbent administration's popularity are the economy and the personal standing of the leader, those now combine dangerously for the Conservatives. The cost of living crisis is both deep and wide, reaching into families that had previously been getting by, albeit with a struggle. It's the mother living off a tin of soup for herself so that her children can eat. It's the parent getting the kids to change into pyjamas when they get home from school to avoid wearing out their school uniforms. But this crisis runs in parallel with Partygate, each revelation of indulgence at No. 10 Downing Street affronting not only those who followed the rules and denied themselves contact with loved ones during lockdown, but all those who do not have the money to put bread on the table, let alone pay for a suitcase full of booze. This is a Marie Antoinette government, pampering itself while too many of its people go hungry. the usual alibis are no longer working. The much-trumpeted vaccine rollout is increasingly offsetting the public mind both by Partygate and the handling of the first phase of the pandemic. Witness this week's High Court ruling that discharging people from hospitals into care homes was both irrational and unlawful. A new opinion poll shows a sharp decline in the number of voters ready to forgive those early decisions just because they're glad they got the jab. Nor does law and order any longer offer its traditional comfort to the Conservatives, not when new figures show overall crime has increased by 18% in the past 2 years, with the proportion of those charged down to just 5.8%. On almost every issue, from inflation to immigration, from tax to housing and the National Health Service, big majorities think the government is handling things badly. Only on defence and terrorism do the Tories get positive marks. No wonder they like to hail Boris Johnson as a leader on Ukraine, though that is of limited political value. Most voters surely sense that today's Labour Party would not be doing anything different. In normal circumstances, you would say this spells doom for Boris Johnson. He lags behind Labour and Keir Starmer on the two big ones, the economy and the leadership. People are far worse off than they were, and they have lost all trust in Boris Johnson. His government is stripped of its defining purpose, leaving it exposed to daily squalls and scandal. And yet, while the evidence is strong that voters are making the break from this government, they're not yet fully sold on the alternative. The old line says it's governments that lose elections rather than oppositions that win them. But changing governments is a two-stage process. First, the electorate moves away from the incumbent party, then it moves towards the challenger. Labour and Keir Starmer have work to do on that second stage, but the first phase is well underway. And Jacob Rees-Mogg's accidental truth revealed one reason why.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.